Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation. A law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. This week on the Signal 51 Chronicles, the Cube's Jewelers Heist. Good afternoon or morning, wherever you are in your day. I'm John Henry with my partner and pal, Jake White, retired sergeant of the Fort Worth Police Department. This is Signal 51 Chronicles, Fort Worth's only true crime podcast. Today we examine one of the most memorable robberies in, if not Fort Worth history, certainly in the last 50 years. The Cube's Jewelers Heist of April 14th, 1978. The impact of the events that day, as we will see in this episode, spread across generations, even inspiring one little girl there to live her life without fear through the example of our protagonist.
This story's proof of how one event can impact a family or families for generations to come. It also drives home the point of how cool it was to be a cop. Seldom do you know the impact you had on lives, and I doubt that David Sears knew the impact he had on many lives on April 14th, 1978.
For us, this case is consequential for two reasons. We began this podcast, the concept of the podcast, Jake, to focus on your expertise and experiences over a 22-year law enforcement career. In this case, however, I'm actually the one connected to the case. My grandmother, Ada Henry, was one of about 9 customers and employees taken hostage when 3 young men entered the store with ill intent on a late Friday afternoon. Their motivation was likely only the loot of a jewelry store. My grandmother being there, though, was actually merely coincidental to the real reason we chose this case for episode 3 of Signal 51 Chronicles. The hero that day, Officer David Sears, died May 15th of this year, not quite too much shy of his 72nd birthday. To his family, friends, and his brothers and sisters of the Fort Worth Police Department, we offer our most profound condolences. This episode is dedicated to the memory and career of Officer Sears. April 14, 1978 was like any other on patrol for Officer Sears, then a 3.5-year veteran of the department. An alarm at the jewelry store he presumed to be a false alarm. Most of them, after all, are mistriggered. It's still that way. Our family met David in an extremely unusual way that was unforgettable and life-altering for us and David, said Rick Cubes at the time of Officer Sears' death last month. It was a Friday at approximately 5 p.m. in 1978 when David, on duty as a police officer, pulled up in his squad car in front of our jewelry store, Cubes Jewelers, for an expected false alarm. Cubes Jewelers opened on Rosedale Street near Texas Wesleyan in the years following the end of World War II and has been in the 2700 block of West Berry since 1948. And at their current location at the corner of Berry and Merida on the north side of the street since 1963. Its founders were Joseph and Rita Cubes, both Minnesota natives, who found themselves in Fort Worth through the circumstances of the war. A U.S. Marine, Joe, after a tour in the Pacific and a victory parade down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and by then a 22-year-old technical sergeant, was transferred to the Eagle Mountain Marine Base in Fort Worth. Now, Jake, I must confess I'd never heard of the Eagle Mountain Marine Base before doing research on this story. Complete news to me. Joe received an honorary discharge not long after his arrival here, and he and his bride, Rita, decided they liked Fort Worth. As Joe's 2005 obituary read, quote, "With $35 to his name and no friends or family within 1,000 miles. The young couple embarked on their grand adventure with fierce determination and an appreciation for the unlimited and bright horizons Fort Worth had to offer. After his discharge from the Marines, Joe had an opportunity to go to work for American Airlines, but Rita convinced him that together they should start a business of their own, Cubes Jewelers, which specialized in watch repair across the street from the university. Under the GI Bill, Joe took advanced training to become Fort Worth's first certified gemologist. Today, the Cubes family continues to run the business with fourth-generation family employees. Jake, I got a break here for voluntary disclosure. Not only was my grandmother part of this story, so am I. My grandmother was there because of me. Then, 7 years old, soon to be 8. During the very, very earliest stages of life, my grandmother bought us all, my older brother, sister, and me, piggy banks made out of some silver amalgam. On them, she had inscribed the dates of the sacraments received through the years as part of the faith formation of the Roman Catholic tradition. For example, the first date on mine reads 8/30/70. Baptism, as a month old, seems just like yesterday. It's probably a good thing she didn't live to see us married. There'd be some scratching off with quarters, or something or another. We can laugh about it now. Well, it was that early April that she had taken my bank to Cubes to get my date of First Communion inscribed. She might have also been doing First Confession, because they were right around the same time. When she returned to pick it up that Friday afternoon, the transaction was interrupted by 3 young men wielding pistols and demanding the works of art of Cubes. To the back of the store, customers and employees, 9 or so in all, were ordered. Travis James Miles, 21 of Galveston, and William Henry Lanier, also 21, and Eugene Bird, 18, both of Houston, were looting display cases when Sears, then 27, entered the store after answering a silent alarm Joe Cubes had activated. Now, Jake, how many times in general does an alarm lead to an actual encounter with a perp?
Officer Sears responded to one of the most mundane calls in cop history, the silent alarm or the audible alarm. Yes, a silent alarm is mundane because 99.9% of the time, it's a false alarm. Whether it be a defective alarm system or it was accidentally set off, the responding officer is typically met by employees who are doing business as usual, no problems, no criminal activity afoot. Although a silent alarm at a jewelry store or bank could have a bit more intrigue and wonder, even those are often false. Now, when you're in training, whether it be in the academy or in field training, it's taught not to be complacent. It's taught to never let your guard down on this type of call. However, after years of answering these false alarm type calls, it is almost impossible to not fall trap to complacency.
They're all false generally. Yeah.
Most of the time, 99.9% of the time. So according to then Officer Sears, longtime work partner, retired Fort Worth Police Department Detective McHorse, Officer Sears thought he was responding to this exact call, a false alarm, a silent alarm, probably not going to find any kind of criminal activity or any kind of criminal element. It's that accidental triggering of the alarm. Officer Sears, still a relatively young officer at the time with 3.5 years of experience, parks his patrol vehicle near the jewelry store and casually walks in. However, what happened next highlights the countless times I or any other cop has been reminded of the dangers of complacency. I say this not to say Sears was complacent. I simply highlight this to drive home the point of how normal this type of call is and was for a cop in the big city or perhaps a small town. Officer Sears entered the store with a casual walk, and I assume he expected to be greeted by store employees who would apologize for the false alarm. This was far from what happened next. Instead of being greeted by store employees, Officer Sears was greeted by Travis Miles. Miles, armed with a .45 caliber semi-automatic firearm. According to Rick Cubes, who was a store employee, son of the owner, and inside the store during the robbery, he said, quote, "In God's divine mercy, the gun had a hair trigger and went off before it was fully leveled at David, and then it jammed." Officer Sears drew his six-shot revolver from the holster and shot at Miles six times, striking him at least three times in the chest.
So critics today would assert that six shots are overkill.
According to witnesses, Miles was high on some kind of illicit narcotic, so the first few shots to his chest did not have the effect Officer Sears needed to see. Ultimately, Miles collapsed and died. Of interest, in Officer Sears' generation, firearms training was significantly different than it is today. First, in 1974, when Officer Sears was hired as a police officer, the revolver was the gun of choice and really the only choice. Second, the reloading drills were centered around keeping the firearm range clean versus practical training. So after Officer Sears emptied all the rounds in the cylinder of his firearm, he unloaded the spent shell casings in his hand and neatly placed them on the counter of the jewelry store. It just goes to show how that repetition of training, how it works and how it can impact how cops respond in the heat of the moment, just like this was.
Becomes second nature.
So this next part amazes me. Remember, he just shot an armed robbery actor who fired at him, and he knew there were more assailants inside the store. I think it was probably via his gut instinct or perhaps screams in the background, whatever, or he possibly even saw them. I don't know, but he knew that there were at least two more additional robbery actors inside. So 1978, no cell phones, no handheld radios on the police officer's belt, no high capacity magazines. This left Officer Sears with a decision. Most likely Sears had 13 more rounds of ammunition on him, or I'm sorry, 12 more rounds of ammunition on him. And he knew that there was at least two more armed suspects inside the store and with hostages. So Officer Sears runs to his nearby patrol vehicle. He notified dispatch on his car radio that this was not a false alarm, that this was a legit robbery with hostages and he needed help. He can't wait for help though. He can't just stand in the wings, hope, you know, waiting for his backup to get there. You know, who knows how long that's going to take. So after he grabs his 12-gauge shotgun, he goes back inside the store. Upon entering the store for the second time, Officer Sears confronts a second gunman.
He did. And a gunman, by the way, who was standing over several customers, including my grandmother and employees who were lying on the floor.
So one of the themes that's come up over the last couple of weeks that you and I have discussed is this idea
of earning your paycheck.
Earning your paycheck. Officer Sears, knowing today was a day he was going to earn his paycheck, pointed his 12-gauge shotgun at either William Lanier or David Byrd. The story is not clear. However, the assailant, as described by a hostage, pointed his gun at Officer Sears, and a short standoff ensued.
So let me get this straight here. We've got one of the robbers pointing a gun at Officer Sears, who is pointing his department-issued shotgun back at him.
Yeah. So picture being in that scenario. What do you do?
I don't know.
I didn't know Sears. He was Detective Sears when I was with the department. I knew who he was. I knew he was a detective with a big mustache, kind of a legendary stash.
Mm-hmm.
He had a low ID number, so I knew he had been around for a long time, and he wasn't one of those boisterous kind of guys on the department. Always just seemed rather calm, rather cool. And as I would learn from his partner, McCourse, Sears was just that. He was cool, calm, and collected. So what happened next, I can only envision as Sears being cool. In a few words, Officer Sears convinced the second armed assailant to drop his gun and surrender. After surrendering, Officer Sears and some backup units that arrived located the third suspect, who was hiding in the attic.
Miles, the alleged robber whom Officer Sears shot 6 times, was pronounced dead at 7 that evening. Police recovered most of the stolen items, which had been placed in 2 grocery sacks, along with the wallets and purses of the hostages, which included my grandmother and her things, and perhaps, I don't know, my piggy bank. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram published this account of the event. Quote, a clerk at the store next door to Cube said he saw 2 men drive by the store slowly and look into the window. They then walked by, looked in our store, and kept going, the clerk said. The man, who said he did not want to be identified, said he heard several gunshots and went outside in time to see Sears entering the jewelry store with his shotgun. Rick Cubes, then 30, said one of the suspects had come in the store shortly before the robbery. He appeared to be casing the place, Rick said. Then he left and came back with 2 other men. I was showing the first man a necklace when they drew guns out of their waistbands and said it was a robbery. They told everybody to freeze and forced us to the back of the store. My first reaction was disbelief. I was caught off guard because they were so young and did not appear to be frightened. Cube said the store had been robbed several times, but Friday's episode was the first time guns were used. Joe Cubes, then 55, was on the floor at the rear of the store when Officer Sears came in. I heard him come in the store, and then I heard 2 gunshots, the elder Cube said. Next, I heard 6 quick gunshots, and the officers commanding the other 2 to surrender. Cubes and his son praised the police for the way they boarded the robbery and handled the situation. Said the elder Cubes, we were all impressed with the way the police expedited the whole thing. I just can't speak highly enough of Officer Sears. He has nerves of steel. The younger Cubes, the Fort Worth police did an excellent job in letting out-of-town robbers know that they can't come into town and expect to get away with this kind of thing. The senior Cubes said he intends to write a letter to Police Chief A.J. Brown, recommending Sears for a commendation. Said Mr. Cubes, in light of the seriousness of the situation, the officer kept his cool and still maintained consideration for everyone who was involved. It's regretful that the young man died. We're just thankful for our lives. The newspaper account went on. In the aftermath, Houston detectives said they wanted to talk to the 2 surviving suspects about a jewelry store holdup there. My grandmother was among those who escaped unscathed, as did my piggy bank, which is somewhere around the house. The last date inscribed on it, the one she had done that week, 4/2/78. Jake, commendations did indeed follow for Officer Sears, the highest form in the department.
They did. They indeed did. So after studying this story, after we discussed it, after we researched it, I wanted to know more about the detective who wore the same badge I did. So I made some calls and sent some social media messages and was able to speak with Detective Sears' wife, Pam, and his partner, Detective McHorse. McHorse gave me the work version of Sears as a person that he called Dad. He wasn't exactly sure why he called him Dad, other than the fact that Sears was older and that he had a steady and calm personality, much like a father may have. So McHorse told me for then, Officer Sears, he later became a detective, for his acts of courage in 1978, he was awarded the Police Medal of Valor. This is the highest honor and one that is so very seldom awarded. However, Officer Sears' acts on that evening fit the description to a T for someone who deserves that award.
So let me interrupt you right quick. The Police Medal of Valor, have you seen it awarded in your career in 22 years?
No, I never saw it. Not that I can recall. I mean,
right.
That's the hero award, if you will. That's the one where you've got to do something, where you've got to save the lives of 9 people. Let's look at what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably saved the lives of all the customers and employees inside the store. He single-handedly stops 3 armed robbery suspects. Unfortunately, he has to shoot and kill 1 of them and then catches the other 2. Phenomenal story. Phenomenal work. You know, it's well deserving of that award.
He, to me, actually saved 10 people's lives that day because he could have easily killed the other robber and did not.
Yeah, and that's something we're going to get into because that was one of the things I found interesting when I was talking to McCorse. I always operate or always assumed, if you will, that times were different back then. And maybe they were. I don't know. I was too young to remember. But I asked McCorse that exact thing. And I said, you know, I found it interesting that he's described even in 1978 as calmly under the circumstances telling a armed robbery suspect to drop his gun and asking for him to surrender. And I think one of the things that stood out was that McCorse said was, you know, things may not have been quite as different as I thought, but the good guys still did the right thing for the right reason. So contrary to, you know, the old stories you may hear, there were still good guys out there, Sears being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So some years later, Sears promotes to a detective. He spent time investigating homicides, robberies, family violence cases, and sex crimes. McCorse said that Detective Sears became a jack of all trades and knew everything about criminal investigations. So in closing with my conversation with Detective McCorse, one statement stood out. And this is one of those statements where you realize how one act can change lives, can change generations, one act from one person. It's very similar. It reminded me of the Admiral McRaven speech during the UT graduation. I think 2014, when he talks about how one person can impact the world. And so 2009 is the year that Detective Sears retired. About a month before he retired, he and McCorse were in the office, presumably tying up some loose ends on some paperwork. Sears is probably excited for his upcoming retirement when his phone rings, his desk phone. He answers the phone and was greeted by a female. And she told Detective Sears she was in Cube's jewelry store during the robbery. What Detective Sears likely did not know was how he impacted her life and many others. Maybe he did, but he actually got to hear it firsthand. She told them how grateful she was it was he that responded, that because of his bravery, because of his ability to perform under the absolute most volatile, extreme, dangerous circumstances, it brought her a sense, in a strange way, brought her a sense of peace growing up, because what she learned from that event was that there was always somebody there that could protect her. You know, like I said, that's the part I found interesting, because I think, you know, Sears, although I didn't know him personally, he seems like many other cops of that generation. He's not looking for accolades. He's not a glory hound who wants the attention or spotlight. Quite frankly, David Sears was natural police who wanted to catch bad guys, and that's what he did for 35 years. Sometimes those pats on the back that you get from people, those genuine conversations that you get from people, that's all it takes. That's the motivation maybe a cop needs, or that's the reward that a cop gets. And I, you know, for that to stand out some, what are we, 13 years later in the minds of McCorse's partner, I think that was a profound moment for Sears at the time too. So I also wanted to kind of know the personal side of him. And unfortunately, I did not get to learn about David Sears by speaking with him. But I did get to speak, had the honor of speaking with his wife, Pam. They were married for more than 35 years, and Pam conveyed the passion for the job that David had. I don't want to go into too much detail. She started to tell me a story about another case that he works, or another case that he had worked. And I think it fits the bill for what we tell here at Signal 51 Chronicles, and perhaps will be a case that we will cover. It's got a lot of interest in that case, so I don't want to go too far off down that road of what it is. But what she described was that detective, that cop that has the relentless pursuit to catch a bad guy. You know, we saw it in our last story with Peyton Cedillo, the 3.5, 4 days in a row, little to no sleep. Same thing that she describes here. That it's that passion that one has for the job to where they go without sleep. They, you know, they do sacrifice a lot, you know, family time, events, things of the sorts. And that was one of the stories she told me that stood out.
Get on a one-track mind. They just can't get off the deal.
Literally. In a weird way, it almost becomes, once you get on a case, it almost becomes an addiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it to my buddies who are still there, who are still working. They're still the same. You call them and, you know, maybe it's a late night, a 9:30, 10:30 phone call, and they're at work and they're in the thick of it. You know, they're on somebody's trail and they're not going home until that goal's accomplished. I think the other thing that in talking to Pam that I really found interesting was this event was something David seemed to carry with him. Contrary to what we may see on the news, contrary to what we may hear, the expectation for cops to be robots, for them to be perfect, for them to be without emotion is unreasonable. Ultimately, in 1978, David Sears shot and killed somebody who quite possibly could have shot and killed 9 other people. But it was not something that was easy. That's something that you're going to take with you, that you're going to relive. There is no pill to cure those emotions and reliving that event. Yeah. So that was one thing she stressed. And I thought that was a point of interest as well, knowing here we are, we have a bank of stories, right? Stories that look interesting to us. Mm-hmm. And like all of them, we dig in and there's, you know, we pull back one layer and there's 10 more layers. And this was another one because, like I said, I didn't know Sears. I mean, we worked at the same police department for 9 years, me from 2000 to 2000, and then he retires in 2009. I didn't know him, but we read this story, we peel back one layer, we're talking to his widow, and learn, like, hey, I mean, this is, you know, this was a hard thing for him to deal with. And I assume it was a hard thing for him to deal with all the way up until his passing.
45 years later.
45 years later.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, I think that that was the reason that stood out to me was again, because of this idea that cops are to be robots or cops are to be perfect or cops should have no emotion. That's far from the truth. Obviously, if it's a mistake of the heart and a cop had ill intentions, I don't know one single cop who says, hey, let's turn a blind eye. That's my personal experience. I'm not speaking for everyone, for every cop out there. I'm not speaking for every police department out there or anything like that. I'm just saying the good cops don't tolerate the bad ones. Mm-hmm. One. Two, there are... You know, this idea of PTSD or this idea of, you know, these tragic events should just roll off the backs of the police officers who were involved is also unreasonable. And, you know, I think there's a lot of organizations out there right now that are taking steps to address that. I don't know the result. I think it seems like a relatively new idea.
Well, see, I was going to ask you, what does the department have any resources available to help officers involved in
shootings. We had that here. There seems to be also a number of nonprofit organizations and things mm-hmm. of the sort that are also offering, you know, whether it be typically it's going to be counseling. There are options that are out there. That police departments and police officers are taking advantage of. Thank God. In closing on my part, I think that one thing, again, how this story went complete full circle on us. So Pam tells me that at David's funeral, just prior to it starting, she's sitting where families may sit during a funeral. I don't know if it was, you know, on the front pew or in a back, you know, in a back room.
Might have been the vestibule or something.
Could have been the vestibule.
Yeah.
When Rick Cubes walks up to her and introduces himself. I don't know that she knew him personally prior to this encounter, but he briefly says, "Hey, this is how I know David, and would you give me 5 minutes to get up and talk at his funeral?" So he does.
I had the honor of making some comments at his funeral because I met his wife. I'd never met his wife,
right.
Never met any of his children, but I met Pam, and I just felt compelled to go to his funeral because, you know, he was there when we needed him, and I felt his family, that we needed to be there when his family needed us. Mm-hmm. So I went to represent the family, and I asked Pam, I said, you know, I would love to say some words if there's an appropriate time. Well, I didn't realize that David would never hardly talk about the shooting. His son did not know anything about it.
Really?
And so, yeah, and so I said, you know, I'm a firm believer that most people that are heroes and do a great job and serve society, especially police officers, teachers, you know, true leaders, they don't get the acclamation a lot of times. They're silent heroes. So I said, you know, his family deserves to know, you know, what he went through and the great job that he did and saving us, helped us, saving our family. And because without my dad being a hero, pushing the silent alarm and David Sears' heroism, I don't know what would have happened with our store. I don't know, you know, and so now we have a 77-year-old business that is a result of people being heroic in a very traumatic time for us. If somebody had been killed in the family, like my dad had been shot mm-hmm. by that hair trigger gun, who knows what the future of Cubes Jewelers and what we offered to the community in terms of a wholesome, you know, World War II era legacy of mm-hmm. Business, mm-hmm. morals and ethics, you know?
Now, keep in mind, I had told Pam our initial interest in this story, and that was the fact that your grandmother was in the store and your grandmother was held hostage while she was getting your piggy bank inscribed.
Right.
So what she told me was that when Rick Cubes gets up, guess what part of the story she remembers? Your grandma getting your piggy bank inscribed. So I thought that part, it's strange how it went full circle and ultimately we uncover this heroic story just by, you know, telling a story of your grandma being held hostage and your piggy bank getting inscribed. It's so kind of cool.
Well, I doubt that our perpetrators that day would have scored much money off of my piggy bank, but
the one thing that I never got closure on was what happened to
the other two guys,
Lanier and Bird.
The other two fellas, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I researched high and low.
Yeah.
I do know that they were charged with robbery. You know, this story, like so many others, kind of just fell off the radar. In regards to the media sources that were out there. So I do think that if there was something different than a conviction, we probably would have seen it. But with So with that being said, I don't know for sure. I know that they were charged with robbery. I don't know what the outcome was.
I have a feeling that newspaper staffs in 1978 were similar to what they are now, in the local realm anyway, and that meant that there were manpower shortages and challenges and probably did not have enough people to cover the courts the way they needed to do it. We can only hope that those guys went and, you know, served their time to society for the crime they committed and went on and lived a productive life. We don't know that, however. But we can only hope. They would be not elderly men, but older. 43 years ago, and they'd be in their 70s.
Yeah.
Let's hope those have been very good intervening years between then and now.
This has been another episode of Signal 51 Chronicles, brought to you by Roxo Media House.